When you cast your eyes out over the horizon and see storm clouds rising, what do you do? What is your response? Do you rely on insights from experts in technology, or do you think for yourself? Do you have a default reaction to threats, or do you employ a multidisciplinary approach? These are valid questions, especially after the year we all have endured. Nothing is as it was, which begs the question, how do you prepare for what may be? According to Harvard lecturer Dr. Vikram Mancharamani, you have to connect the dots and think for yourself. He says generalists may be better suited to navigate ambiguous situations than specialists. The key, he says, is to learn how to anticipate the future, manage risks, and spot opportunities. In his book, Think for Yourself, he urges a return to common sense. He says you have to look at each situation through a variety of lenses. Some are financial, others are technological, and others could be demographics, just to name a few. We invited Dr. Vikram Mancharamani to join us for a conversation that matters on how to navigate your way through uncertainty.
Conversations That Matter is a partner program of the Center for Dialogue at Simon Fraser University. The production of this program is made possible thanks to the following and viewers like you. Please become a patron at conversationsthatmatter.tv.
Vikram, welcome to Conversations That Matter. Thank you for joining me. You're in New Hampshire, aren't you?
I am today. Yes, Stuart. Thank you for having me.
You know, we're talking about dealing with uncertainty, well, in uncertain times. We've got coronavirus that has swept its way around the world, but that's not the only big issue that's at play. What are, you know, some of the top issues that we need to be thinking about as we prepare ourselves for the year and the decade ahead?
Sure. So, Stuart, the way I think about it is I'm a big believer that every single perspective and every single lens we would use to interpret the world is limited and biased. And as such, my approach to thinking about the future and navigating uncertainty is to utilize multiple perspectives and multiple lenses. So let me just do that very briefly. If I look through an economic lens, I say, wow, the world had this big lockdown. We've had a real demand shock in a negative sense, less demand. By the way, if we look through a technology lens, you've had a shock in a positive sense, more supply. So more supply, less demand. Look through a demographic lens very quickly and you say, uh-oh, the world's aging. At least the world's largest economies are. And then you say, well, that's less demand. And so you know, you start putting a couple of these things together, less demand, more supply. You know what? You see prices are falling. And actually when prices are falling, we have a deflationary risk, especially problematic when the world has a lot of debt. And we can come back to that if you want. But the shorter term problem is when there's too much supply in aggregate relative to demand, countries start competing in different ways, and they use their currencies to become competitive in international trade. They get more aggressive when it comes to nationalist policies. And so, you know, there's a little bit of chest thumping behavior happening in a geopolitical sense, and that has the possibility of surfacing in ways that produce a lot more uncertainty. So to answer your question, what would I watch out for? Number one, I think this deflationary pressure really puts risk that the central banks of the world will continue to print. And that means the paper currency you have in your pocket might be worth less. It probably also means you should try to find some currencies that can't be printed. Now, historically, that's been gold. Other people call it Bitcoin. I don't have a view. I just like currencies that can't be printed. Secondly, you got to expect a lot of these dynamics around inequality because of these sort of technology and other dynamics are going to get worse. And that increases the probability of unrest and sort of uncertainty in a social sense. And then the third tidbit I'd say is technology is not, that's a genie we're not putting back in the bottle. It's just, it's out and it's going to get worse. You're going to see more people able to produce a lot more with the same or fewer inputs. That has implications for jobs, that has implications for the economy, that has implications for productivity, has implications for national security, that has implications for privacy. I mean, I can go down a long list here. But anyway, I've been long-winded in answering your question, so let me pause there.
Well, you touched on aging populations. I was just reading in The Lancet this morning, actually, that the aging population in the Western Pacific, particularly Southwestern Pacific, there's now more than 750 million people there over the age of 65, and that is the fastest growing age group in Southeast Asia. So when we take a look at aging populations, what kinds of pressures do they put on systems? Because as you said, there is a drop in demand for products.
Sure, there's two things that happen very quickly when people age. Number one, they move to fixed incomes. So right off the bat, they spend less. Secondly, all else equal, I'm not trying to be disrespectful to older listeners or watchers, people in the audience here, but older people tend to need more healthcare. And so there's a spending surge in healthcare. So more healthcare, less spending on consumables, and a greater burden put on society in the form of needing to care for, support, et cetera. And so generally it's viewed as a negative that societies are aging, right? They used to talk about a demographic dividend when you had a young population of, lots of young workers who were going to enter. They talk about a dependency ratio of sort of how many old people to how many younger people, et cetera. I think the economists of the world that model this out with the demographers have got it wrong. All right, so here, I'm gonna say something relatively controversial. I think this idea of a demographic dividend is exactly 180 degrees wrong. Here's why. Take a country like Japan, which everyone admits is aging so rapidly, they've got so few people, they're not having babies, their young population is not there. This is a demographic disaster. Well, let me ask you, compare that to a country like India, where there's a lot of young people that all want jobs and, they're cheap labor. Surely that's a demographic tailwind, right? Well, Now let's introduce robots. Well, you can introduce robots into Japan pretty simply, easily. There's no social disruption because the workers are retiring and you still need medical care, you still need support. Now, I'm not going to say robots are replacing all humans, but surely they can augment staff without social disruption. Now introduce robots into India. Uh-oh, you're gonna prevent people from getting jobs? And lots of them. This is a problem. I actually think a large population of unskilled labor, which historically was a great input for a development strategy around industrialization, that's no longer the case. China might have been the last large country to emerge a large middle class from a development strategy around taking farmers to factories. So I think we've got some different things. We need to think this differently.
Well, if we take a look at population growth projections in sub-Saharan Africa, which are expected to surge here over the next 50 or 60 years, can sub-Saharan Africa follow the Chinese model, which is we're going to attract manufacturing here. We're going to build a worker base and a consumer base, much the way that the Chinese did? Or is it too late there? And if it is, well, then what are other potential strategies to help, this emerging population bomb meet its needs?
Yeah, so first of all, wonderful question. And here's why. I think very few people understand the population surge that is likely to happen in sub-Saharan Africa. And I just want to make it tangible for the audience. So a lot of us understand the size of Texas, big country, big state, right? Relatively large state, geography wise, a lot of land area. Texas has, give or take around 30 million people. Happens to be that Texas has roughly the same land area as Nigeria. Nigeria has today what is thought to be around 200 million people. We're already talking about a density of people that far exceeds, Texas is sort of spread out, maybe that's not a big deal. Well, now let's play it forward using the demographic trends based on fertility rates, mortality rates, improvement, education, et cetera, model it out. What's gonna happen to Nigeria? Now you use the sort of 50 to 60 year window. I'm gonna say, let's look 80 because I've got the data for 2100. By the year 2100, Nigeria, a country the size of Texas, could have up to somewhere between 850 million and a billion people in a country the size of Texas. That's a problem. There won't be the infrastructure, there won't be the medical care, there won't be the food, there won't be this basic resources will be in scarce supply. So that can't happen. So something's gonna give. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what or how we'll give, but I agree with you. It's worth highlighting that the current trajectory of demographics in sub-Saharan Africa should cause alarm for lots of people. Now, to your second question of could they emerge the way China did? Could they bring global manufacturing and industrialize? And here, I think the answer is no, a very blunt no. Why? Because taking the farmer to the factory was possible when the workers plus a robot equaled greater output. Today, it's an unskilled, illiterate farm worker competing with a robot. The robot doesn't complain. The robot doesn't have a need for particular religious holidays. The robot actually, if it makes a mistake, the engineer fixes it. It doesn't make the same mistake twice. And so generally, there may in fact be manufacturing and industrialization that comes to areas like sub-Saharan Africa, but that isn't really the question. The question is, will it bring jobs? And will those jobs generate income to produce a middle class of consumers that can help create sort of domestically sustainable economies? And here I'm kind of negative. I'm not sure. I'm sort of thinking technology has the edge here, at least for now. Now, we can put gears in those sands. We can put sand in those gears, excuse me, sand in those gears to sort of slow down the progress and therefore increase the probability that there'll be more humans needed in different capacities.
Right.
That's seemingly a tough battle to win.
Well, where we are going to need more people, though, is in northern hemispheric countries that are, I think, I like to call it the prosperity conundrum. The more you prosper, the lower your birth rate, and you have this aging population, but you don't have the next generation coming up behind it. So where are they going to come from, and how are you going to manage that? And as you pointed out, when there's deflation, there's a rise in nationalism and populism. Can we figure out some way to help people around the world, you know, move around so that we are fulfilling the needs of everyone?
Yeah, look, so there's some really interesting academic work that was done on migration and economic impact. And so let me throw out the bottom line sort of summary, and then we can work backwards from there. The bottom line is, if we got rid of national borders and allowed free migration, immigration, and emigration, that global GDP likely would double. Mm-hmm. All right, so that's a huge number. That's gigantic. Except the problem is the winners and losers are not evenly spread. The Africans would benefit dramatically. The Europeans would lose out dramatically because GDP per capita in Europe would fall dramatically, so they would suffer. But the Africans would rise more than the Europeans lost. Likewise, same thing with Latin America and North America, and you could see this pattern around the world. And so, again, it was very preliminary guesstimate-style thinking from the form of a handful of academics. But, you know, there's a question here, which is, it's not about whether or not we can unleash productivity. It's a question of who benefits and who loses. And this is why those trends that point to nationalism and protectionism are so problematic, because they're pushing against this natural growth possibility and our sort of fulfillment of potential. And so, you know, it is worth thinking about. This nationalism logic says, you know what, don't talk to me about the global tide rising and all boats getting lifted. I'm not interested in that. What I'm interested in is my slice of this pie. And my slice can be the American slice, it can be the Indian slice, it can be the Chinese slice, etc. And that creates a different friction.
Yes, it does. And I can understand why people go there, but to have that mindset, you know, before we were on camera, you and I were talking about, you know, the interconnectedness of everything, the flapping of a butterfly wing in Brazil and what the impact of that is. For us to say, no, we're going to build walls around ourselves and isolate us from them, I don't think we can do it. I think we are in such an interconnected world that to be able to say, no, you have to stay over there, even though you don't have what we do, ultimately you're going to rise up and you're going to take it from me. So do we not then have a responsibility to not just ourselves, but our own future offspring to say, we have to figure this out so that everybody benefits, because otherwise we're just going to go into chaos.
Yeah, look, I think what you're hinting at is something I've spent a lot of time thinking about, Stuart, which is fundamentally our sense of identity. Now, it's going to sound wishy-washy and off topic, but bear with me for 15 seconds. What I'm talking about is I have an identity as a resident of, as an American. I can also have an identity as an academic. I can have an identity and I can feel that I am a member of the Indian immigrants who came to America. My family came in the 60s. I was born here. I could have an identity in numerous ways as a father. I could have an identity as, you know, as a writer, etc. You can also think about it geographically. I can be an American. I can be a North American. I can be a Western Hemisphere, or I could be a global citizen. And who and how you define your tribe as being changes how you address all of these topics we're thinking about. If I think of myself as a global citizen, as a member of, you know, the species on planet Earth, I think differently about these interconnected problems. If instead I think about my group as being this small, you know, my family only, well, then my neighbor becomes an enemy, right? Because it's me versus. And so there's a gradation here. I tend to believe, like it sounds like you do as well, that we are all interconnected. This is one planet. This is, you know, an integrated system. And so we need to work together. We have to be able to appreciate different perspectives, including those that may seem opposite ours, because ultimately that's what's going to get us through a lot of this otherwise chaos-destined trajectories that we find ourselves on.
You know, in the presentation that I first met you through watching that, you had a slide up there from Peter Drucker talking about it's not the, you know, the turmoil that matters. It's the kind of thinking that we bring to that turmoil. And how important is that, that we start to set aside some of those old ways of doing things in trying to address very new and significant challenges?
Yeah, I think it's critical. I think we do have to think differently about things. We can't, and by the way, it could also be the situation that on topics where we, you and I could violently disagree on some topics, but could cooperate on others, that we might need to find ourselves operating in a world like that. That, I mean, here in the United States, the, you know, the political situation, one might say, has been a little polarized lately. and it's created some crosscurrents. Now, it may in fact be that there's 50, 70% agreement, and maybe there's 30 to 50% violent disagreement. Okay, I'm not saying that's good. I would hope we'd have less of that disagreement. But even in that situation, there's 50% agreement. That's something worth pursuing and building on, right? There can be good from that. And so I do think we need to look and focus a little bit more globally, domestically, in all ways, at sort of on the common ground. The possibility frontier, the stuff that we can make progress on, with the hope that as we work together positively, constructively on stuff we agree needs to be addressed, that perhaps in that process we learn to appreciate the other person's perspective. And while we may never change our view, we may appreciate theirs, and that could at least possibly head towards a negotiation where we find some common middle ground.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more. However, I see the kind of discourse that's going on even within North America, the way that people are, like, they're not just nipping at one another's heels. They're taking out a baseball bat and hitting each other on the side of the head. I don't like the way that you said this line or that your view on that. How then do we find common ground? And if we have these big, and they're not just national, they're global challenges, how do we start to find that community of people who are willing to say, yes, we can disagree on some things, but we can find that common ground that's going to allow us to find solutions?
Yeah, I think what you have to do is stop thinking about it as people and start thinking about it as topics, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's not I agree or disagree with Stuart. It's that Stuart and I agree on this topic of economics. So it's the economics topic. And I have one community of agreement there. And okay, in a political topic, I may have a different community of people who I agree with. And so we need to stop making it the person. It has to stop being the identity being defined as sort of you versus me. Doesn't allow the nuance of, well, you know, Stuart has different thoughts and some of them I might agree with and some I might disagree with, and that's okay, right? you know, that's okay. It doesn't mean you're a bad guy because you disagree with me on one thing, right? And so part of it is this identity-driven politics, which I find so distasteful, rather than issue-driven logic. Because there are issues where we will all, you know, some groups will agree and others won't agree, and that's okay. So I think I think it's a hard shift. It's easy for me to talk about these shifts. It's really hard to do in that emotional state, particularly the political leaders.
So based on your energy and the depth of, you know, thinking that you've put into the challenges that we face, are you an optimist?
You know, I generally am, and here's why. I think I'm not willing at this stage to bet against human ingenuity. So when it comes to topics that seemingly are existential, like climate change, that everyone, you know, I've spent a bunch of time with some Silicon Valley entrepreneurs and really fascinating, creative, imaginative types that are saying, look, climate change is just like every other problem. It's just a problem. Let's engineer. There's a solution. We'll innovate. We'll find it. What do we need to do? Suck out carbon atoms out of the atmosphere? There's too much carbon dioxide? Fine. We'll figure out some filtration logic. We'll get some material science guys involved. We'll get some bacteria that eats carbon dioxide. We'll figure this out. This is just a challenge. Like, that's what we do in Silicon Valley. And, you know, there's a whole field of geoengineering that will rise. Likewise, you can talk about, oh my goodness, we're gonna have so many people on the planet, not enough food. We're gonna have mass famine. Well, you know, there's different ingenuity happening in sort of creativity and entrepreneurship and innovation happening in food technology. Right? So there's stuff there as well. So I am ultimately, in the long run, an optimist. I do think the human creative mind will step forth and, you know, we'll be able to solve some of these problems or address some of these challenges. Where I get nervous is in some of the tribalism that's been emerging, and tribalism defined more in the short-term sense of, you know, me versus you, this identity politics, the polarization, and with the one caveat that I really do get nervous about here in the sort of short to medium term is this U.S.-China rivalry. And that's probably a topic for a whole nother discussion, but because that's a can of worms I don't know that we want to open just yet. But there is a really great power rivalry can redefine a lot of dynamics. Everything from national security to economics to even what happens in space. And so I think that's the one sort of asterisk I'll put on the side there, which is I'm an optimist. I think we're going to rise to a lot of these challenges. However, I do worry about major disruptions that can transpire and the big major global disruption that I think is a near to medium term risk is U.S.-China escalation of tensions.
Well, because we're out of time, I want to extend an invitation to have you come back in the future and have that very discussion. Thank you very much for taking the time to have this conversation with me today.
Great, Stuart. Thank you for having me.